As we pointed out last night, it was Stalin who was the engineer of the defeat of the Second Chinese Revolution of 1925 to 1927. And that is because Stalin saw in the Kuomintang a revolutionary nationalist anti-imperialist movement. And in January of 1926, for instance, the presidium of the 14th Party Congress of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, headed by Stalin, sent greetings to the Kuomintang. But as events proceeded, they began to redefine the nature of the Kuomintang. And as I indicated, the Kuomintang was not an anti-imperialist or a revolutionary or even a nationalist movement. It was composed of the Chinese national bourgeoisie, which happened to be the compradors of the Western imperialists. They were neither revolutionary nor nationalist nor anti-imperialist. At any rate, in 1926, this greeting that the Presidium sent to the Kuomintang called it a liberal party of the bourgeoisie and of the Chinese Communist Party, because now the Chinese Communist Party had entered the Kuomintang, so now it was composed of the national bourgeoisie and the Communist Party. Now, that's quite a conglomeration when you think of it. Here's a party that consists of the party of the bourgeoisie, as they define it openly, and of the Communist Party. Then a little further on, Stalin called it a party of workers and peasants. Then again, it was redefined as a revolutionary bloc of workers, peasants, intellectuals, and urban democracy, a community of class interests against imperialists and feudal militarists. And this is the famous bloc of four classes. Now the Kuomintang was converted by Stalin into the capitalists, the workers, the peasants, and the urban petty bourgeoisie all together in one party. And when one of the right-wing bourgeois politicians of the Kuomintang, Hu Hanmin, visited Moscow, here is how his reception was described in Pravda by the TASS reporter. Quote, "When the Generalissimo, the Canton Army, stepped up to the tribune in military uniform," for this occasion, this bourgeois politician had put on the military uniform of the Kuomintang, of the armed forces that the Russians had armed and furnished to the Kuomintang. "For several minutes, the speaker was unable to commence speaking on account of the continually renewed applause. These demonstrations of enthusiasm lasted several minutes and punctuated nearly every sentence of the speaker." And then this right-wing Kuomintang leader went on to speak. And here's what he said. "There is only one world revolution, and the Chinese revolution is part of this world revolution. The slogans of our great leader Sun Yat-sen are identical with the slogans of Marxism and Leninism." Let me just say on the side that Sun Yat-sen had guaranteed private property in capitalism, but he didn't mention that. Then he went on, "I feel I am one of the fighters for the world revolution, and I greet this session of the Communist International. Long live the solidarity of the proletariat of the world. Long live the victory of the world revolution. Long live the Communist International, and long live all the comrades here," unquote. There were big applause, and that was how they hailed him. So as I said before, they are not short on revolutionary rhetoric when they have to be, the bourgeois politician. This was the same person that executed all those comrades that he could get a hold of that he had just hailed when he went back to China that he could catch. So you can't trust what bourgeois politicians say. But Stalin fell for it. Chiang Kai-shek also visited Moscow. He had a meeting with the Chinese communists who were studying Moscow at the University of the Toilers of the Far East there that was led by Radek. And it so happens there's one survivor of that group. All the others were executed by Chiang Kai-shek, whom he assured, you know, in this little convivial get-together, that he was for the revolution and for socialism and what have you. Anyway, the admission of the Kuomintang into the Third International as a sympathizing party was approved. There was one vote against. It was Trotsky's vote. So you can see, sometimes it pays to be in the minority, even if, I mean, sometimes it pays to be right, even if you're in the minority. At any rate, just to repeat, the Leninist or the Trotskyist view of what a proletarian movement should do in relation to such a movement is that it should cooperate in practical matters in joint anti-imperialist actions on which both sides agree. There should be joint struggle on commonly agreed upon objectives, but no organizational or political subordination of the workers' movement to the bourgeois nationalist or anti-imperialist so-called movement. This, however, was not carried out in China. The Communist Party was subordinated politically and organizationally to the Kuomintang. It ignored the right-wing coups in Canton and even in Shanghai, and continually moderated and held back the mass movement so as not to frighten away the rest of this Kuomintang. And they even physically disarmed the workers when the workers were willing to struggle to fight the Kuomintang to save their own necks, rather than have them fight them, just to carry this policy out. Now the Maoists, the Peking chroniclers, say the following in their history of this period. They say, quote, "The new democratic revolution led by the Communist Party." Now what do they mean by the new democratic revolution? They mean the bourgeois revolution. So you have this two-stage theory of the revolution. First there's the bourgeois revolution, then there's the socialist revolution. They say, "The new democratic revolution led by the Communist Party." Let me absorb that for a minute. The bourgeois revolution led by the Communist Party went through four historical periods, the first revolutionary civil war. And what do they mean by that? They mean Chiang Kai-shek's northern expedition as he marched north from Canton to establish the Kuomintang as a national government. That they consider the first revolutionary war, civil war. The Agrarian Revolutionary War, the War of Resistance against Japan, and the People's War of Liberation. And they go on to say, it took 28 years in all, from 1921 to 1949, to solve the problem of seizing power by armed force, unquote. Now, the time periods that they have is logical enough. You have 1921 to 1927. That's the second Chinese Revolution. Then the second period is 1927 to 34, the third period 35 to 45, and the last period 45 to 49. But the nomenclature that they use is designed deliberately to wipe away the objective situation, any ebbs and flows of the revolution. They substitute armed struggle in each case as the be-all and the end-all of what happened. See, each one is a war. First Civil War, the Agrarian War, the War of Resistance, and the People's War of Liberation. Was there a revolution in any one of these periods? And what happened to it? That is simply wiped out. Then there is a chapter in that same 1971 History of the Communist Party that I've been quoting from, that's issued in Peking. The next chapter is headed, "Persistently follow the road of seizing political power by armed force." That's the whole program already. That's the title of the chapter. And here we read, quote, "Marxism-Leninism holds that the fundamental question of revolution is political power, and that the seizure of power by armed force is the central task and the highest form of revolution. This is the universal truth of Marxism-Leninism," unquote. And then you read the whole chapter. And you have to have eagle eyes to find out any reference to the industrial proletariat in this elaboration of the universal truth of Marxism-Leninism. Completely forgetting that Marx, you know, ascribed a crucial role to the proletariat in this process. Instead, they say the following. You need only three ingredients for the revolution, and I'm quoting Chairman Mao now. As they do, Chairman Mao pointed out, a communist party, this is what you need for making a revolution. A communist party built on Marxist-Leninist revolutionary theory and in the Marxist-Leninist revolutionary style. An army under the leadership of such a party. And thirdly, a united front of all revolutionary classes and all revolutionary groups under the leadership of this party. These are the main weapons with which we can seize political power and consolidate it, period. The industrial proletariat, the objective situation has disappeared. All we need is an army under the leadership of the party, incidentally, this army is of an undefined class nature, just an army. A communist party, and a united front of all revolutionary classes and all revolutionary groups. What classes? What groups? Another block of four classes, not spelled out. And the Communist Party is going to be a Stalinist party, because that's what he means in the Marxist-Leninist style. That's what he is referring to. And then there's more. We're informed that in various articles written in the years 1928 to 1930, Mao Zedong, quote, explained on a theoretical plane that in China, the seizure of political power by armed force could be accomplished only by taking the road of setting up rural-based areas, encircling the cities from the countryside, and finally seizing the cities, and not by taking the cities first and then advancing into the countryside as in the capitalist countries, unquote. That's quite a picture of how the revolution proceeds in the capitalist countries, too, but let's leave that aside for a moment. So we not only have the ingredients of the revolution, the party, the army, the united front of all classes, but also in what order they have to appear from the countryside into the cities. Now, there's any number of radical people influenced by the Chinese Revolution that have tried to take this Maoist formula and apply it to their own countries, only to find out to their regret that it didn't work. And as a matter of fact, this isn't what worked in China either, as we will try to explain. It didn't work right after the Second Chinese Revolution, in the late 20s and early 30s. First of all, Mao didn't outline this strategy in these articles that they refer to, but that's another question. It also led to the defeat of the Kangxi Soviet period of 1931 to 34, when the Chinese Communist Party did establish quite a large area that was under the control of the so-called Red Army controlled by the Communist Party, when actually their peasant army controlled or constituted a force that was equivalent to that of 1945. And the question arises, why couldn't they have taken power then? Their army was just as big as it was later on in 1945. Well, the Maoists have an explanation for that, but it moves on the level not of the objective situation, but on the subjective plane of the mistakes of the party leadership. They say, quote, there occurred Chu Chupai's left putschist line between the end of 1927 and the beginning of 1928. Then came Li Lishan's left opportunist line between June and September 1930. Then there was Wang Ming's left opportunist line between 1931 and 34. Therefore, the party suffered a loss of 90% of the Red Areas, and the Red Army was compelled to leave and embark on a long march into the hinterland. So that's their explanation of why this strategy didn't work then, that the leadership in control, which was not Mao Zedong, made mistakes. That's their explanation. But this is the same methodology of Stalin. That's scapegoatism. It isn't that the line is wrong, it's that they didn't carry it out right. That's why it failed. And you avoid any analysis of the defeat in this manner. There's nothing wrong with the objective situation. There was nothing wrong with the line that they applied. What was wrong is that they didn't apply it right. The subjective factor takes the blame for everything, and particularly the people in charge of the party. Now, what were the real lessons of 1925 to 27, and what really happened after the defeat of the Second Revolution? Let me try to very briefly delineate those. The Second Chinese Revolution showed, first of all, that a mass revolutionary party could be built in a very short period of time. In 1921, at its foundation, the Communist Party had 50 members. In early 1924, it had 400 members. In early 1927, it led a successful insurrection in Shanghai. It counted close to 60,000 members. It had another 35,000 members in the youth organization. And in addition, it led mass movements composed of workers and peasants, composed of millions and tens of millions of members. This happened in a few short years. They were able to build this mass organization, even with their wrong line of entering the Kuomintang. Now, left to its own devices, and if the leadership of the Communist Party itself had been able to set its own line, which was to break with the Kuomintang after they had been forced to enter, and they were unwilling to enter even before that and did so under the orders only of the Communist International, they would have led the Chinese proletariat to power in the 20s, in 1927, 1928. Because the Chinese workers showed their capacity for organization and their revolutionary dynamism in the Second Chinese Revolution. In Canton, in Shanghai, in Wuhan, in elsewhere, there were boycotts, strikes, mass actions, successful insurrections, and so forth and so on. It is only the policies imposed by Stalin upon the young Communist Party and its inexperienced leadership that kept the Chinese workers from taking the power in the Second Chinese Revolution. For instance, even after the Shanghai coup of Chiang Kai-shek in April of 1927, the revolution was not yet lost, even though Canton and Shanghai, two revolutionary centers, had fallen to the right-wing militarists. The revolution had received a blow, but it was by no means a mortal blow, because as Chiang Kai-shek suppressed the mass movement, he came to depend more and more on naked military power, and as he did so, his mass influence declined. His overall influence grew less and less. And the worker struggles and the peasant uprisings continued in the rest of China, even while they were defeated on the coast. But in the interior of China, the revolution continued full-fledged. As a matter of fact, in Hunan, in the interior of China, right smack in the center of China, in central China, as a matter of fact, the worker struggles and the peasant uprising continued, and this was the biggest peasant movement since the Taiping Rebellion of 1850. Tens of millions of peasants were organized and in revolt. There were 3 million organized trade unionists in Wuhan, which was an industrial center in the Yangtze River Valley in central China. It was at this crucial point in May of 1927, after the Shanghai coup, that a debate took place between Trotsky and Stalin at the Central Executive Committee of the Communist International in Moscow at the 8th Plenum about what policy to follow in China. Stalin pledged complete support to the left Kuomintang that controlled this central China area in the full sweep of this peasant and workers' revolution. And he urged restraint upon the mass movement so as not to frighten the bourgeoisie and the landlords. Trotsky advocated Soviets should be formed, armed units of the workers and peasants should be constituted, agrarian reform should be carried out, and the Communist Party should break with the Kuomintang and act independently. And if this had been adopted, the Chinese Revolution would have gone on to victory despite the military coups in Canton and in Shanghai. But Stalin had the votes at the plenum, and they outvoted Trotsky. And then the Wuhan government made its peace with Chiang Kai-shek, suppressed the mass movements in central China that had been disarmed by the Communist Party so as to carry out Stalin's policy. And they drove the Communist Party underground in the middle of July 1927. You can see how crucial that plenum of the Communist International was. Well, after this defeat, it was becoming clear even to Stalin that there was something wrong with the policy he had been following in China. So without giving up any of the theoretical positions that he had held in the debate with Trotsky, he made a turn. He made a panic-stricken left adventurous turn that made matters even worse. Trotsky put it very succinctly. He said, the undertaker of the Chinese Revolution, that Stalin, took fright and ordered ultra-left paroxysms that all but liquidated the Communist Party, what was left of it. So Stalin proclaimed, well, this alliance with the Kuomintang, the so-called national bourgeoisie, that had merely been an inevitable stage. And now, without the bourgeoisie, the revolution would only reach a higher stage. And any mistakes on the previous policy were blamed on Chen Duxiu, who had objected to the policy, the general secretary of the Communist Party. And Trotsky's criticism of this previous alliance were countered by saying, in the face of all the evidence to the contrary, that the Kuomintang was still an effective instrument to carry out the Chinese Revolution. Except now the Kuomintang was who? Who was the Kuomintang now? All the bourgeois politicians had become counter-revolutionary. It was now the Communist Party that was the real Kuomintang. And the others were all sham Kuomintangs. And what this meant in practice was that the Communist Party was still carrying the banner of the Kuomintang in its battles and all its endeavors, saying that we're the real Kuomintang, these other people that carry the Kuomintang banner, they're false Kuomintang. So to the peasants and the workers looked like it was some kind of faction struggle between various cliques in the Kuomintang, this counter-revolutionary party, and they weren't concerned with it at all. That was the policy that he instituted after the defeat. Trotsky held that the revolution had been defeated, the catastrophes that had befallen the workers and the peasants signified an ebb in the revolution. And what was required now were rearguard defensive struggles for democratic rights. Stalin insisted the revolution was still on the rise, and he called for armed insurrections in the city and the countryside. That's after the revolution had been defeated. Well, what followed then are the Nanchang uprising, the autumn harvest actions, attempts to manufacture general strikes in Shanghai and Changsha and elsewhere. Changsha is the capital city of Hunan, the native province of Mao Zedong. And it all culminated in the disaster of the Canton Commune of December 1927. And all of these were catastrophes and disasters that made things worse. Since the Maoists continually refer to these events, let me go through them very briefly, what they are. You know, the glorious uprising of Nanchang, etc., and so forth. And you have the Maoist art always pictures, you know, these heroic uprisings. Let's see what it actually happened. The Nanchang uprising was a military putsch to take over the capital city of Jiangxi, which is another Chinese province in the interior. In the expectation that the taking of this capital city, this provincial capital, would electrify the whole area south of the Yangtze River and transform the situation in one blow. Now, you know, just about a month before, the general labor unions that were led by the CP had turned over all their arms to the Kuomintang to show their good faith. Now they were making armed insurrections. They sought to make up for their previous errors by taking over a portion of the Kuomintang army that they happened to control, because there were communists in the leadership of portions of the Kuomintang army, despite the fact that the Kuomintang politicians had been very careful not to let communists or known communists get into the leadership in any portion of that army, which, as I said, was armed and trained by the Russian advisors. They happened to be Ho Lung, Ye Ting, and Chu Te, You may have heard these names or come across them. So anyway, being on the communist officers, these Kuomintang units surprised the other units that weren't led by communists. Before dawn on August 1st, 1927, they occupied the city of Nanchang without firing a shot, so to speak. Nobody knew what was going on. And without involving the population, which happened to be completely indifferent to the whole thing, because they made that insurrection under the Kuomintang banner, not under the communist banner. Now, because so many future leaders of the so-called Red Army participated, just such as Lin Bao, for instance, and others, the anniversary of this putsch of Nanchang is now celebrated as the Red Army Day in China. And even Mao is pictured in Maoist art as firing the first shot against the Kuomintang at Nanchang. But this is fiction. It wasn't fired against the Kuomintang because they themselves were operating under the banner of the Kuomintang, and Mao Zedong wasn't there. He wasn't in Nanchang. But anyway, the pictures look good. And they set up a fictitious Kuomintang Revolutionary Committee to rule the town. That's one of those real typical Stalinist type committees, which I'm sure you have encountered. It even included, you know, as members, the general against which they were mutinying. He was a member of this committee too. But as soon as he heard about it, he mobilized his other forces and marched against Nanchang. And as soon as this general against whom they revolted mobilized his forces, they had to leave the city because they only had about 3,000 soldiers, and they immediately withdrew 2 days later. And then they marched through the hills and lost more and more of their forces and eventually were dispersed by October. There was a rear guard under Chu Tae that circled back to Hunan after rallying to the Kuomintang for a while, which was very conventional, was done all the time. Certain units of the Kuomintang or the warlord army would revolt, then they would rejoin again, then they would revolt again, and the units were continually changing sides. That was part of the whole warlord atmosphere in China. Anyway, they joined the Kuomintang for a while again, and then joined forces in April of 1928 with Mao's small band that was left over from the Autumn Harvest Uprising, which I'll go into in a minute, holed up in the Qingkan Mountains. And that too, you see that in the Maoist art. Chu Tae and Mao Zedong joined forces, and a very heroic kind of thing in the popular imagery of Maoist art. So the Nanchang Uprising, it ended in defeat. And as I indicated, this kind of military insurrection was not at all unusual in this period of China. It was a weak central authority. Units were continually switching around. Warlords were always revolting against the central authority or fighting each other. And military units were always switching sides, depending on which one looked stronger. And even the Kuomintang, after the defeat of the Second Chinese Revolution, never was in complete control. It was never really a centralized strong power in China, even under Chiang Kai-shek. There were continual revolts of the various units and provinces and so on. Well, let's go into the Autumn Harvest Uprising. Mao Zedong was assigned to lead the action in the regions to the east of Changsha, the capital city of Hunan, his native province. The idea was to take over the capital city of Hunan province and then again electrify all of China. The communists have taken over, and then maybe the whole situation would be reversed. There were also similar attempts made in other provinces, in Kwantung, Hubei, Shanxi, Honan, Hopei, etc., etc. None of them amounted to very much, and as we shall see, neither did the Autumn Harvest Uprising organized by Mao Zedong. He started out with about 3,000 men composed of Kuomintang deserters, Anyan coal miners, and peasant militias, and they were divided into four regiments. They didn't have any military experience, they didn't have any popular support because they were marching under the Kuomintang banner, They sought to take the local district towns in the eastern part of the province before converging on the provincial capital. But the population of Changsha failed to respond. The 4th Regiment switched sides and attacked the 1st Regiment. The 2nd Regiment was encircled, and the 3rd Regiment marched into an ambush. And Mao was almost, or he was captured, but managed to escape. And there's some very unclear things there about how he managed to escape or precisely what happened. At any rate, he finally ran after the retreating remnants of his forces and finally caught up with them. He abandoned all thought of taking Changsha, and with less than 1,000 men, succeeded in reaching, during the last weeks of 1927, the mountain fastness of Qing Khan. The Qing Khan Mountains, in Chinese, are Qing Khan Shan. The Shan means mountains. On the Hunan-Kiangxi border, which was a traditional refuge of peasant rebels and bandits all through Chinese history. As a matter of fact, there happened to be some bandits holed up there, about 600 of them, and Mao joined them into his forces. And the autumn harvest uprising everywhere else ran into the same problem. Well, Mao was rebuked by the Communist Party leadership for calling off the Changsha attack. And he was dropped as an alternate member of the Political Bureau in retaliation. He was accused of cowardice and relying more on military force than on mass agitation and action. But again, that wasn't his fault. He was made the scapegoat. That's all. The policy was wrong. And of course, his abandonment of the attack on Changsha wasn't any difference with the policy either. He just wanted to save his own neck and that of the small band that he led. As a matter of fact, he was one of the Communist Party leaders that stressed most of all the necessity of seizing cities at the time. He wasn't any partisan of any peasant base setting up at all. He wanted to seize a city. It just so happened he was forced into that situation. Being holed up now into this mountain fastness, he sought to increase the control over this ragtag army that was half traditional bandits now by establishing party cells in each squad of soldiers. And through the so-called soldiers committee and political training to compensate for the large percentage of D-class elements that were in this army. Now the composition of this band that Mao Zedong led so alarmed the Central Committee that that's the reason they ordered Chu Tae to join, so maybe to bring up the proletarian level or the revolutionary level, so-called, of this army. And in the meantime, being left on his own resources, holed up on the mountainside, Mao began to evolve certain rules for survival for this band, such as good behavior towards the population, to treat them well so as to be able to inform, use them as informational activities, use them as spies against the Kuomintang army, and also to be able to have more flexible tactics to be able to retreat when the other side was more superior than they were. Now, in so doing, this wasn't something that Mao Zedong had to invent, or had to break a new path in the history of China to come to these conclusions. As I indicated last time, there were 8 major peasant wars in the past 2,300-year history of China that toppled dynasties and established new ones. There was a rich heritage of literature and cultural traditions about peasant wars. There were famous novels. You know, like in this country, you read novels about the Western frontier. In China, the young people read novels about peasant revolutions and how the peasant revolutions fought guerrilla wars and toppled dynasties. The tales of the great Taiping peasant rebellion were still alive in the oral tradition of central China. The parents and the grandparents had lived through it, had participated, and had passed on the tradition of that to their younger sons and daughters. There were these classic novels of bandit heroes and guerrilla warfare that everyone had read. And even the guerrilla tactics evolved by Mao had been codified by classical Chinese writings on the subject by Sun Tzu, who happened to live 500 BC and is considered the classic military expert in China, who had manuals on how to have guerrilla warfare to topple dynasties. So there was nothing really new about the tactics that were evolved there. It was in the Chinese tradition. Now, even after the defeat of the Second Chinese Revolution, even after the masses had been crushed in Hunan and in Wuhan in central China, the rest of the peasants on the countryside that had been roused to action in the preceding period had not cooled off, and they continued to revolt. But the Communist Party, with its Moscow-dictated line, had not been able to tap this as yet. That comes later. But see, a peasant revolution isn't defeated in a capital. It isn't defeated in an urban area. You know, especially in a country like China, where there's millions and hundreds of millions of peasants in the countryside, the revolution may be defeated in half the country or in three quarters of the country, but it continues in the one quarter of the other side of the country. It's like a tremendous elementary wave that continues. It is not beaten down at any particular time. So the aftermath of the Second Chinese Revolution, the peasant revolutions, continued. And in the meantime, Stalin in Moscow took the continuation of these peasant rebellions in the hinterland as a sign that the revolutionary wave continued. He absolutely refused to accept any of Trotsky's analysis that the Second Chinese Revolution had been defeated, that rear guard actions were on the order of the day, but continued to stress armed insurrections. And even after the defeat of these ultra-left adventures, including the Canton Uprising, where a couple of hundred of Communist Party members armed themselves and took over the city for a day or maybe 18 hours, something like that, and proclaimed the Canton Commune. Now, they formed a Soviet in Canton, and this was a big switch for Stalin. At a certain point, it got to Stalin by way of the Communist International Representative in China that in the Nanchang Uprising and the Autumn Harvest Uprising, the Communist Party leaders on the spot learned you can't march around China with a Kuomintang banner and have anybody follow you after all that's happened. We've got to march under our own banner, the red banner of the Communist Party. So finally, even Stalin saw the merit of that, and they were allowed to use the red banner of the Communist Party, call themselves the Red Army, in whatever military units they had, and to call for Soviets. Well, that was a big switch. That's what Trotsky had advocated, having Soviets, you know, at the height of the revolution. But now, after the defeat of the revolution, the order came from Stalin, form Soviets. Well, Chu Pai, who happened to be the leader at the time, saw, well, if now the order for Soviets, that means, and we march on our own banner, that means the socialist revolution has arisen, and they formed this Soviet in Canton, this artificial putsch by a couple of hundred of CPers that armed themselves, and they constituted the Soviet. Well, after this commune in Canton collapsed after a few hours, Stalin explained that he had meant not Trotsky Soviets, not Soviets of workers, but bourgeois Soviets. That these Soviets were to carry out the first stage of the revolution, the bourgeois revolution. And he blamed Chu Pai for misinterpreting his line, and he was cashiered and made the scapegoat for the failures. But you can see a slight contradiction here, calling for Soviets, bourgeois Soviets, to carry out the bourgeois revolution. Now, the Sixth Congress of the Communist Party that met in August of 1928, at the same time that the Sixth World Congress of the Comintern was meeting in Moscow. See, Stalin didn't even want the Communist Party to have a national convention in China anymore. He got the leaders to Moscow under his very eyes and nose so he could really tell them what they had to do. And they tried to maintain as many of Stalin's wrong theoretical positions as possible. The formula now became the democratic dictatorship of the proletariat and peasantry under the hegemony of the proletariat was to be established in China. It asserted that the revolution in China was still bourgeois democratic in nature, despite the fact that the bourgeoisie had gone over to the feudal counter-revolution. Now, all of this, you know, would be of very passing interest, and I wouldn't mention it here, except the Stalinist claptrap has been taken over by Mao Zedong and has continued to this day. To this day, Mao Zedong sticks to the Stalinist formula that was elaborated at the Sixth World Congress of the Comintern in 1928. Now, the democratic dictatorship of the proletariat and peasantry, as you probably know, was advocated by Lenin in 1905, and it was dropped by him in the April Thesis in 1917 when he went over to the formula of the Soviet power, or workers' power. This 1905 formula of Lenin was predicated on the fact that a genuine peasant party would arise that would be in alliance with the workers' party. No such party arose in Russia, no such party arose in China. But this theoretical straitjacket that was invented by Stalin in his fight with Trotsky to buttress his theoretical position on that plane is clung to by the Maoists very tenaciously up to this day. As a matter of fact, that's why they don't understand the class dynamics of the forces that brought them to power. To this day, they don't understand it. For instance, the 1971 booklet says the following, and I already quoted portions of that. The new democratic, that's the bourgeois revolution, led by the Communist Party, lasted until 1949. Now, how a revolution that is led by the Communist Party, that brings it to power in a civil war against the bourgeoisie, can be termed a bourgeois revolution is astonishing. Especially when just a few lines before they write, quote, Marxism-Leninism holds that the fundamental question of revolution is political power. And then to compound the confusion, right after that they say, the accession to power by the Communist Party is a seizure of political power by the proletariat. So there's a bourgeois revolution led by the Communist Party against the bourgeoisie that leads to the seizure of political power by the proletariat. It sounds like they're trying to elaborate the permanent revolution, but don't know quite how to do it. But what they're trying to do is to refute the permanent revolution. They're trying to squeeze the permanent revolution into this two-stage theory. They invent non-existent feudal classes against whom the bourgeois revolution that they led against the opposition of the bourgeoisie was supposedly led against some feudal classes that exist in China, which didn't exist. That was up to 1949. And then the seizure of power by the proletariat then the class struggle with the bourgeoisie begins after 1949. And that's why all these Communist Party leaders that are purged by Mao are called bourgeois capitalist rotors. See, that now is the socialist revolution to them, the second stage. Now they're fighting the bourgeoisie. In other words, all the people they are struggling for workers' democracy and against the bureaucracy in China now are conceived of as the bourgeoisie because they're following this two-step revolution schema. In other words, the basic lesson of the Russian October eluded Chairman Mao just as it did Stalin. That the bourgeoisie is counter-revolutionary in this epoch, and that the bourgeois and the proletarian revolution are intertwined and they can't be separated in the semi-colonial country. At any rate, having established himself in a rural-based area towards the end of 1927, while agreeing with all these theoretical straitjackets of Stalinism, he had to face a very practical question. How to survive, how to live another day in these surroundings. And with Mao, that question was always connected with how he would maintain his own position as leader in the area. Now, in so doing, in facing this question of how to survive in this rural-based area and how to maintain his own leading position in that rural-based area, Mao expressed not so much the requirements and the demands of the Chinese peasantry as those of the Stalinist bureaucrats, that section of the Communist Party of China now, that was linked to the armed detachments that had to survive in the rural-based areas. And there was any number of conflicts now between Mao and the center that was still underground in Shanghai and that was transmitting the orders from Moscow. Now, some of the bourgeois professors have taken this conflict between the various portions of the Communist Party bureaucracy, those connected with the armed detachments, and those city intellectuals that were trying to carry out the orders from Moscow, as a break with Moscow on the part of Mao. But that's not true. Mao was simply trying to carry out the orders from Moscow under the practical circumstances, you know, that he was immediately confronted with and that he could see much clearer than the people that were underground in the cities. And his preoccupation was how to carry out the Comintern instructions better so they would be more successful. Now, there were five groupings in the Communist Party after 1928. There was a central leadership faction that was controlled now by Li Lisan. There was a trade union grouping, two of them. One was led by a man by the name of Ho Meng Sheng, and Lo Chang Long was the other one. Let me call them Ho and Lo for short. They still had some influence in the trade unions and among the working class in China, and they represented the working class or proletarian influence in the Communist Party of China that remained even after all these debacles. Then there was another clique that controlled the Communist Party youth organization. That was a separate set of leaders or bureaucrats. There was then the Red Army faction. That was the Mao Zedong, Chu Te, Peng Tehuai sector. Those were the leaders that were in the leadership of rural-based areas. They constituted a separate grouping in the Communist Party. And lastly, there was a group of Trotskyists that were led by Chen Duxiu and Peng Shuxie, who was the fifth grouping in the Communist Party. And they, of course, finally were able to get a hold of a document written by Trotsky that analyzed the reasons for the defeat of the Chinese Revolution of the 20s, and they agreed with it wholeheartedly, and they tried to expose the mistakes of Stalin and of the Communist Party leadership subsequent to the defeat on a political level. As soon as they did so, they were expelled in November of 1929. But even after this expulsion, there were great numbers of rank-and-file members in the Communist Party were sympathetic to the views of Trotsky, including Chou Enlai, Liu Shaoqi, and others, but who didn't dare break with the Communist International, with Stalin, for financial and economic reasons, even while they politically agreed that Trotsky and the left opposition of China had been right. Now, the remaining groupings were not held together by any clear-cut political program, but it became a clique struggle. With the exception of Ho and Lo's group, who expressed the interests of the Chinese workers in the distorted form, but still expressed them, because they disagreed with this ultra-left adventurous policy of insurrections in the countryside, or in the city, for that matter. Now, under the influence that we're talking now, we're coming to the period of 1929. There was a stock market crash in the United States, the beginning of the Great Depression. And under the influence of the Great Depression that appeared on the horizon, Moscow issued directives that called for accelerated preparation for insurrection in China. The worldwide new revolutionary wave had begun, And that whole ultra-left period started on a world scale at that time. So at the end of 1929, in the early 1930s, there was about a dozen communist-controlled areas that came into being in the hinterlands, in seven provinces in central and south China. The reason was, as I indicated, that the peasants were still rebelling. It was still the same wave, although it was a receding wave. And in the meantime, the peasant-based guerrilla areas had learned how to survive under those conditions and had begun to attract the peasants to their banners. And the armies under their control, composed of these peasant rebels, began to swell quite a bit. They reached something like 60 to 70,000 guerrillas, armed guerrillas, by April 1930. Of course, they dubbed them immediately the Red Army, which meant that there was some kind of proletarian force. It wasn't. It was a peasant guerrilla force. And the peasants had good reason to revolt and keep on revolting. They had nothing to lose. They were crushed totally by the dearth of the land. They were chafing under the yoke of the militarists and the government officials. They were ground down by usurious loans. So they continued to rise up. The workers in the city had been totally crushed by the counter-revolution, but the peasants were diffused over the countryside. There were so many of them, hundreds of millions of them, that no military force could possibly put them all down. So these rebellions continued, but it was a receding wave. Moscow, on the other hand, conceived of that as the new wave, a new starting wave of revolution. And they began to elaborate again and again plans for insurrections in city, plans for capturing capital cities, linking guerrilla attacks and urban strikes, triggering nationwide revolution. Now, it so happened, while they issued these orders, when they came back to Li Lishan, the leader of the Communist Party in China, the implications of what they had done began to sink in to the people in Moscow, as well as to Ho and Lo, who commanded the workers' forces. In other words, whatever city workers they still controlled were now ordered to stage urban insurrections. And Ho and Lo and the workers in the Communist Party that were left knew it was suicide in the city to try anything like this. So they began to have second thoughts. Then Li Lishan said, fine, we'll stage insurrections and so forth. Send in the Soviet army to help us. At this point, Moscow said, what? I mean, that's going a little bit too far. But it was logical if you order a Communist Party in the country to stage insurrection and revolution for them to say, fine, you know, where's the Soviet army? You know, give us a little help. So they withdrew from that. And then, of course, the bureaucrats in the rural base areas also began to have second thought. Attack Changsha again. You know, we tried it three times already, and each time we lost 90% of our forces. So they began to drag a little. Now, Ho and Lo fought the leadership programmatically. That is to say, they drew up counter-resolutions, and they tried to have a discussion of whether or not this policy is rational. Mao and the Red Army bureaucrats didn't do anything as political as that. They just dragged their feet. They got orders to attack. And they said, well, yeah, we're not ready yet. Give us another week, 2 weeks. And then when they marched very slowly. They got lost, you know, that kind of thing. It's might call administrative sabotage, you know. But they swore they were carrying out the orders. They just never happened to get there in time or something like that. Sort of a minimum foot-dragging fashion. Well, I don't want to go make any pointed remarks, but it's possible to carry out directives and policies in that manner if you disagree with them. It's incorrect, however. You know, if you disagree with a policy decision, you fight it politically, not in this foot-dragging fashion. Well, again, it turned out to be a complete failure. And again, Stalin blamed Li Lishan for all the failures and catastrophe, deposed him, said he was a semi-Trotskyist and so forth, framed him up, and set in another leadership. So the Wang Ming leadership now comes in that was sent in by Moscow to take over where Li Lisan had left off. And they dominated the central leadership of the Communist Party until a Long March period of 1934. Now let me say one more word about the Ho and Lo leadership that was left, faction that was left in the Communist Party. They actually enjoyed the support of the majority of the rank and file in early 1931. But again, there was a very undemocratic, hastily called plenum of the party, called by the Communist International Representative Pavel Mif, who had been sent in, and he quickly imposed that Wang Ming leadership. Ho and Lo protested the undemocratic nature of this plenum that set in this new leadership, and the recall of the Communist Party representative, Mif. And organizing themselves, they met in Shanghai, you know, to discuss what they should do about this. And the British police arrested them and handed them over to the Kuomintang, and they were all executed. Now, those that were left charged that the Wang Ming leadership had tipped off the British police to get rid of the opposition faction. Well, anyone that claimed that was then in turn expelled from the Communist Party. So he ended up with the Trotskyist, anyone that was known, expelled, and with anyone that disagreed with the leadership that was put in by Moscow, also expelled or executed or turned over to the Kuomintang. And there followed extensive purges inside this Communist Party. And in this series of actions, the Communist Party became completely bureaucratized and Stalinized. As a matter of fact, in the aftermath of 1927, the Communist Party had established its own secret police inside the party to weed out Kuomintang police agents inside the party, who managed to point the finger at tens of thousands of Communist Party members and got them executed. Now, in April of 1931, the director of this Communist Party police was captured by the Kuomintang, and he in turn began to inform on the secret police apparatus and all the things that he knew. So about 4,700 party members were arrested in 1931. Many more in the succeeding years, so the Communist Party was under tremendous pressure by the Kuomintang. But the secret police, which was headed by Chou Enlai after the capture of this original police chief by the Kuomintang, began to institute its own terror campaign inside the party, supposedly aimed against Kuomintang agent, but aimed also and later on even primarily against any oppositionists that remained in the party. Just as Stalin used the Gepeyu in the Soviet Union against the opposition now, inside the Communist Party in China, they established sort of a miniature Gepeyu that would weed out oppositionists inside the party. Now this was especially true in the base areas and especially ones that Mao controlled. He became a past master in using Stalinist police methods in weeding out his own opponents inside that base area and maintaining his position. In 1928, after the debacles of that period, he had maintained his position in Ching Khan Shan only with difficulty. He lost his post for a time as army commander and the political commander in the party to somebody that had been sent in by the provincial committee, who was technically, you know, on top of the rural base area. Then Mao managed to score a coup and remove this representative that was put in by the provincial committee. And that gave him the control of the so-called Fourth Red Army. And then there were all kinds of clique struggles again, pushing and pulling between the rural commanders and the central leadership. And this resulted in a big struggle, the so-called Futian incident, which was always shrouded into mystery. Nobody knew what he was until lately when some of the documents came to light upon what was actually involved. What was actually involved was that in the mid-November period of 1930, to complete his control of the Kiangxi observation, of the Central China operations, of the Soviet areas, as they were called there, Mao's forces arrested about 4,400 members of the 20th Corps of the so-called Red Army and accused them of being Kuomintang agents. Then in December, another section of the 20th Corps attacked Mao's units in Futian and freed all the people that he had arrested, saying that the accusation had been a fabrication. They accused Mao of unnecessary ruthlessness and established a rival Soviet government to that of Mao in that rule-based area. Then Mao's forces counterattacked, and it took months to suppress the dissidents. And there were widespread executions and mass trials, but the purges and the polemics and the appeals continued for years after that. And what it was is that anyone that disagreed with Mao's personal dictatorship in the rule-based area was crushed in this manner. And even the central leadership recognized this, and they put Mao, rebuked him, and almost put him on trial and demoted him for that. In 1931, Mao's conduct was openly criticized. Even Mao's supporters said, like Chu Te and Teng Fa, condemned him for sending communists to their death by framing them up. They say something like this. This is a Central Bureau resolution of 1932. The indiscriminate use of prisoners' confession and physical torture has made counter-reaction work a subjective proposition. Many revolutionary organizations and offices have been destroyed. A reign of terror has been created among the masses. And the most serious problem is the fear within the party. This is all as a result of Mao's operations. And they analyzed what it was very succinctly. They said all of this resulted from unprincipled factional struggles that resulted in indiscriminate killing. And this Futian incident, as it's called, constituted the bloodiest purge of the Communist Party history until the Cultural Revolution of 1960s, where Mao repeated that kind of operation on a much bigger scale. In other words, Mao was the foremost opponent of bloodletting as a means of consolidating his authority in the party in the early 30s. And it did strengthen his leadership in his position in the Kiangxi Soviet area, in this rural-based area that had been established in the Central China area. And it led to his election as chairman of the Executive Committee of the First National Congress of the Chinese Soviet Republic that was established in November 1931 in Jiuquan in Hunan, in Central China. And he also became the chairman of the Government of People's Commissars. Now, the central leadership began to move in on Mao's fief, however, and eventually he was deposed and lost his chairmanship of the Soviet government that had been established in this area, and his key position in the military apparatus is dead. And it wasn't until after or during the Long March at the Zunyi Conference in 1935, after the defeat of this whole Kangxi Soviet area, that Mao was able to reestablish his leading position, or some of his leading position, or his former position. But this decline has rankled Mao no end, and you can see it in what they write in Beijing. He has stuck to the title chairman ever since. That's what he was chairman of the first provisional Soviet government in Jiuquan. And the Peking historiographers have these voluminous excoriations against the Wang Ming leadership for having practiced sectarianism, for depriving Chairman Mao of his power. And that's why he's so fond of that title, Chairman Mao, because they took it away from him, you know, in 1932. Now, in 1945, in this party resolution that I pointed to before that falsified the whole history of the Communist Party to elevate Mao to such a preeminent position, thoroughly revised and falsified the Kangxi period historical record. Once he had secured firm personal domination of the party leadership, which happened in the period 1942 to 44, Mao set about to make scapegoats of everyone else, including the Wang Ming clique. And his purpose was to discredit them for all political time as potential rivals and to build himself that same myth of omniscience and infallibility as Stalin had. And so he made a Wang Ming the scapegoat for the Kangxi Soviet defeat. But the real cause of the 1934 Kangxi defeat I've already pointed to. It was the incorrect appraisal of the period that was held by the CCP, including Mao. It was not an acute revolutionary situation. It had never been after 1927. So they looked in the opposite period of the class struggle, in the period of ebb tide, they looked towards an ascending scale of class struggle. They abstained from working in the trade unions. They wouldn't have anything to do with the so-called yellow Kuomintang unions that had been established after the defeat, in which the majority of workers were fighting for maintaining some level of standard of living and some level of their rights. And they frittered away whatever combativity remained in these adventurous actions. They refused to enter any kind of united front activity with other working class or in anti-imperialist forces. So the workers' movement, the peasant revolts, and the anti-imperialist sentiment was isolated and was allowed to be beaten down by Chiang Kai-shek, you know, separately. And in the end, the Communist Party deserted the city workers altogether. They shifted all of their cadres to the countryside. They placed themselves in control of the peasant guerrillas, who fought many heroic battles, that's true. But the city workers were crushed by Chiang Kai-shek and were allowed to be crushed because of these third period adventures, and therefore could not respond to the peasant insurrections in the countryside. And therefore, the peasants were crushed eventually. And this was the reason for the defeat of the Kangxi Soviet period. But again, Mao Zedong has never shown any sign of understanding the reason for that defeat. And that defeat led to the Long March, where they marched for 6,000 miles on foot, way, way to the hinterland in the north. And by the time they reached there, the original force had been decimated. Out of maybe 100,000, there were perhaps 20,000 left. A heroic undertaking, but you know, a rearguard retreat just the same. Now, no sooner had they gotten there when the line changed from adventurism to the Popular Front. Following Hitler's rise to power in Germany, Stalin switched to the right, sought to secure the security of the Soviet Union by the so-called collective security blocs with France and other nations in the name of collective security, establishing and calling for popular fronts everywhere, alliances with the so-called peace-loving capitalists. Now, this Stalin's turn towards the imperialist democracies was unquestioned by the Communist Party leaderships throughout the world, and they wheeled into line behind Moscow. And Mao was no exception. So the Chinese Communist Party veered now toward the policy of an alliance with whom? Chiang Kai-shek. They turned right around and offered Chiang Kai-shek an alliance. And the guerrilla war was to be liquidated in favor of a coalition with the bourgeoisie on the basis of Chiang Kai-shek's program. Now, that wasn't too easy to sell to the Communist Party members that had just gone through the Long March. And Mao was the chief agitator to put that line across. Here's what he says in the selected works, for instance, to argue for this shift towards the alliance with Chiang Kai-shek. In what respect does the present period differ from 1927 when Chiang Kai-shek betrayed the revolution? China was then still a semi-colony, but now she is a colony. Over the past 9 years, the national bourgeoisie has deserted its ally, the working class, and made friends with the landlord and comprador class. But has it gained anything? Nothing, except the bankruptcy or semi-bankruptcy of its industrial and commercial enterprise. Hence, we believe that in the present situation, the attitude of the national bourgeoisie can change. In other words, it's true he slaughtered us in 1927, but now he can change. And he was proposed to abandon the workers and the Soviet Republic that they had established for a People's Republic. Now, Chiang at first resisted Mao's entreaties and the openings made by the Communist Party. Then in December of 1936, the Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek was kidnapped by some of his own officers who favored a more active policy of resistance toward the Japanese invasion, which had started by then. And Chu Enlai and the Communist Party personally intervened to save Chiang Kai-shek's neck and to get him to sign an agreement for a united front against Japan. But it was not a united front, you know, as we understand a united front, in which the proletarian forces maintain their organization and programmatic independence. He publicly abandoned all demands for socialist measures and for land reform, even. In other words, even the bourgeois program. They abolished the Red Army. They incorporated their army units into the National Revolutionary Army. They issued a proclamation that formally renounced the policy of overthrowing the Kuomintang of China by force. And they accepted the principle of Sun Yat-sen, which were those of private property, as the program of the Communist Party. So he scrapped the agrarian reform, entered the bloc with the Kuomintang, supposedly to strengthen the war of resistance against the Japanese invasion, which began in real earnest in July of 1937. And of course, Chiang Kai-shek's government received massive aid from the United States as well. But Chiang refused to fight the Japanese. He would only fight those units of the Red Army that had been incorporated into his army, try to ambush them, surround them. And as a matter of fact, after having done so, Mao was even ambushed portions of the formerly Red Army that had been incorporated into the Kuomintang, refusing to fight the Japanese. And even after this, Mao was willing and did hand over rural base areas that they controlled to the Kuomintang, which of course executed all the peasant guerrillas that they could find and so forth and so on. And the result of this policy was not a strengthening of the war of resistance against Japan, but a complete paralysis of it. Now it's true, whenever the former Red Army units fought the Japanese, they fought very valiantly, and they received a tremendous reputation for that among the peasants and the workers of China. And Mao's regime reputation rose on account of this, but the total war of resistance was hindered by these programmatic concessions. In 1945, this takes place until the Japanese surrender, until the Japanese imperialists are defeated. And then this same kind of maneuvering continues for a while, until finally this sort of uneasy alliance that was established by the total surrender of the program of the Communist Party and its incorporation in the Kuomintang Army was broken not by Mao, but by Chiang Kai-shek, who ordered a full-scale assault against the so-called liberated areas, the areas that the Chinese Communist Party still had formally controlled, and which they still control in these units that were now formally part of the Kuomintang Army. He threw something like 2 million troops into an offensive, and they did capture the Maoist capital of Yan'an. And all this time, Mao still sought to compromise, to call off the fighting through a political settlement. All they wanted to be is to have a capitalist regime established in China, and they would be a minority opposition that would be tolerated. In other words, they wanted to establish the same kind of regime that the Italian or French CP established after the war, a coalition regime with the bourgeoisie in which they were allowed to be an official legal opposition. But all of this was rejected by Chiang Kai-shek. But Mao found himself now not just, you know, attacked by the Kuomintang, but also by the angered peasantry who, for the sake of the war, had allowed itself to be coerced into abandoning land reform and had settled for a few decreases in land rent during this period of the war of resistance against the Japanese. And they rose up and continued to fight and began the program of agrarian land reform. There was a long period of hesitation what the Communist Party should do now. They were sitting between these two chairs. On the one hand, this angry peasantry that was beginning to execute the landlords and carry out the land reform. And on the other hand, being attacked by the Kuomintang. And the negotiations with Chiang Kai-shek had collapsed. So finally, as a measure of pure self-preservation, they allowed the land reforms to go ahead. They allowed the peasants to carry out the liquidation of the landlords. But they kept pussyfooting around the question of whether or not they should call for the overthrow of the Chiang Kai-shek regime. And they never really raised that part of the slogan until there was a worldwide left turn on the part of the communist, well, the Cominform, as it was called, by Stalin in October of 1947. That's when the people's democracies that had been established in Eastern Europe began to turn towards the so-called salami technique, where they began to saw off the bourgeois members of the government that had been established and to transform in a bureaucratic, military manner the proper relations in Eastern Europe. This same time turn, finally, was allowed by Stalin to call for the breaking with the coalition with the bourgeoisie that finally allowed the Communist Party of China to make that turn, to break with Chiang Kai-shek officially and call for his overthrow. And there ensue 2 years of war now in which the Chiang Kai-shek regime collapses. And there's no other way to describe what happened to the Chiang Kai-shek regime, except that it collapsed of its own weight in that period. And this leads to the accession of power by the Communist Party in 1949. Now, again, did they understand the lessons of that defeat? Did they understand what really happened? And the answer is no, they didn't to this day, and I'll go into that in the next lecture. I think I'll stop here and let you ask some questions then.
Okay, before we go into questions and discussion, I have a few announcements to make. This is part of a whole
Yes. After the question was whether there was an actual break in, this is taking place in 1927 we're talking about now, when for a period of time after the Shanghai coup and after the Wuhan coup of the left-wing Kuomintang, where the Communist Party posed as the Kuomintang. And the question was whether there was an actual break where they broke with this policy and went over to fight under their own name. Yes, there was. After the debacle of the Nanchang Putsch, after the defeat of the Autumn Harvest uprisings, the authorization came from Moscow. They could fight under their own banner now, and they could establish Soviets. That was a little bit later on. Does that answer your question, or isn't that the question? Yes. Yeah, they denounced the Kuomintang all during this period of the Kiangxi Soviet and the Long March, and they didn't make a turn back towards the policy of alliance until after the turn was made at the Sixth World Congress towards popular frontism. All right. Yes, they called for sections of the Kuomintang, for the officers and the men of the Kuomintang armies to desert and join them, and some of them did. And when they crossed the Yangtze River, almost the whole apparatus of the Kuomintang went over to their side, not just the soldiers who joined them in droves who would desert, but even sections of the left Kuomintang, one of whom was I think it's Li Chi Sun is the name, who happened to be a butcher of the 1920s, who, as far as I know, still sits on the People's Government in China, and who was incorporated into the new government that was set up. And as a matter of fact, they still do this to this day. Not too long ago, there was a Kuomintang general that deserted, flew to Shanghai, and was welcomed, and they issued a proclamation just recently welcoming anyone that wants to desert from Taiwan. Officials of the Kuomintang government was welcome in China. And they released, as a measure of goodwill, they released some Kuomintang officials that they'd held in jail all over since 1949, just recently issued an amnesty. So that's been their policy all along, to incorporate Kuomintang officials that go over to their side, which caused them a problem, as we'll see, as they want to complete the revolution after they take the power, because they took over the Kuomintang governmental apparatus, you know, lock, stock, and barrel, especially south of the Yangtze River. So, you know, they invent all these myths and illusion-making even after that, and continue it to, in some extent to this day. The real initiative for the break came from Chiang Kai-shek in 46 and from 47 on. And of course, once that kind of a struggle is victorious, very difficult to stop it and call for a coalition again. You know, once the momentum succeeds. Once they had to go over to calling for completing the land reforms, once the peasant armies that they control are unleashed, it's very difficult to stop them and try to have another coalition. You won't find them in Mao's bookstore. No, I would recommend the archives in Taiwan by the Kuomintang. Or the bourgeois professors have hold of them. Yeah, you do much better with... They have the original documents. People like Schramm, Harrison, and some of the, you know, the bourgeois professors have the original document. Well, then you have to learn Chinese if you want to go to the original sources. Harrison, The Long Road to Power is a good word.
Yeah, I have a series of questions. Some are just repetitions I didn't quite get from your talk.
What was Stellan's position in the debate between Stellan and Husky at the 8th plenum? I'd like to repeat that. And what was the reason given in 1932 for taking away Mao's chairmanship in the wake of that? And then...
I got a good... Wait a minute. Let me answer these one by one, maybe. Well, all right, go ahead.
Okay, and several times, both last night and today, you referred to the fact that there were no feudal relationships on the land. Maybe I misunderstood before, no feudal classes on the land. And it's my understanding that the basic mode of production was a very, very backward agrarianism, and there were landlords, and there were peasants, and there were usurers, and there were artisans. And within the family, a very few relationship with the family, which is extremely important. And so I wanted you to go into that a little more. I understand what you're saying about payment to rent, payment to mercantilists, and payment to the dynastic state, but I don't think that's sufficient to say that there were no feudal relations on the land, which is important from my perspective, because I'm concerned with the feminist movement, the support of women to the revolution. And they were a vital element in it, and they were tied to the land reform and the breakup of the old family structure. And then another question, you talk about these the proletariat, the role of the proletariat, and the theories in Russia. I don't think that Trotsky's theory of the permanent revolution was in any sense designed as a model for other countries internationally, but was very specifically for Russia. It was historically specific and you know, specific for that country. And so I want you to say, what was the proportion of the proletariat in Russia to the peasantry quantitatively? And secondly, what was the qualitative nature of the proletariat in China in the sense that, you know, what were the industries? I was told by a professor that tends to be a Maoist that but he claims to be a Marxist, that the industries in China were very, very small. An industry itself was just almost a cottage industry. That qualitatively couldn't even be compared to Russia in 1917. And finally, I'd like to make some comments on your talk last night, some additions. I think it was a great talk, but on the role of women, Confucianism said, and Confucianism reigned very strongly in China, that the woman owed three obediences. Obedience to the father, obedience to the husband, and obedience to the son when the husband died. And there were all kinds of columns and pillars to women all over China for two things, chastity and unilateral obedience. These were the highest values that were held. The first movement, the first person to raise the question of equality women was the leader of the Taiping Rebellion. Yeah, but I think it is important to bring in the role of women, of course, since they played such a fundamental role in the revolution, it's the final revolution in 1949.
Well, first of all, Trotsky's theory of the permanent revolution, while it was elaborated in the Russian context, has general applicability and was always understood to be that by Lenin and the Communist International, who incorporated into the general international program the theses of the Communist International as it applies to underdeveloped and colonial countries. And I have never heard that it only applies to Russia. That's a version of Russian exceptionalism. It was elaborated by Trotsky originally in relation to Russia. But, you know, even if it applies only to Russia, why doesn't it apply to other countries? Because there's no proletariat in China? Or that the proletariat plays a qualitatively different role? That was rejected by the Communist Party of China from its earliest founding. They were a working class movement that started out as a student and intellectual movement, but based itself on the workers. I mentioned the figure of the organized trade unionists just in Wuhan, in the central China area, 3 million organized trade unionists. There were, Chenot, who's a French sinologist, estimates that after 1917, in the early 20s, There were 1.5 million industrial workers in China. And there were any number of smaller, these are large concerns. And the weight of the Chinese working class was just as crucial and dynamic as the Russian working class in relation to the Russian peasants. So that there's no qualitative difference there whatsoever. And the second Chinese revolution proved that. The Chinese Communist Party could have made that revolution, and they knew it and everyone else knew it, based on the workers and in part also on the peasantry. The feudal relations on the countryside. Well, you get into a lot of terminological problem because there's a lot of loose terminology here, because especially since the Maoists refer to the feudal classes which did not exist, that supposedly they overthrew in 1949. And the feudal relations they refer to, nobody can point their finger at. Trotsky held, and the Marxists have always held, I mean, those that weren't Stalinists, that the capitalist relations dominated the village economy in China. That is, the money relations, and that the world trade relations and the capitalist relations had penetrated the Chinese village, just as it had penetrated the Russian village, which caused the peasant unrest. That was the reason for the peasant revolts and rebellions. It wasn't the old dynastic cycle anymore. It was now the results of the effects of the penetration of world capitalism and of money relations and of capital relations into the village economy. Yes, it's true, patriarchal relations existed in China. And I hope nobody thought that I'm a supporter of Confucius, you know. It's just that I'm a supporter of historical truth, who Confucius was and what he said, rather than the distortions that the Maoists play with his historical role or what he said or what he stood for. And certainly in the patriarchal relations, the women and children are oppressed, and we're against that. And one of the factors of the revolution was the breakup of the patriarchal relationship in the countryside. But you can have patriarchal relationships under different social systems. It doesn't have to be feudal or slave. It can be capitalist. You have patriarchal relations under capitalism as well, if not even before the slave society as well in the transition. But the main point we're making is that, you know, which relations dominated, which were dominant. You can see slave relations in the patriarchal family setup as well, but they're subsidiary. They're not the main method of production in the society. Why was Mao deposed? Well, there was that typical struggle that I implied. Different portions of the CP bureaucracy are constantly fighting each other. That has continued after victory, continues, and was a feature of the party before, as it became bureaucratized and Stalinized. He was deposed because he had gotten too powerful for the central leadership to impose their will upon, and they had to cut him down to size. It was a clique struggle. There were no programmatic issues involved that anyone can detect who actually studies the original documents. And they had any number, you know, the official justifications for that he didn't carry out the land reform as he was ordered to. He was lagging his feet in that and this and the other thing, that kind of a thing. But some of it were slander, some were true. It was a clique struggle where the issues, you know, aren't programmatic or political, just for the control of whatever forces they control.
Are there any further questions? Okay, we can take about a 5 or 10 minute break before the next class starts at around 3 o'clock.